This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kevin Phillips, has written a new book that was the subject of a question put to President Bush by a member of the audience yesterday when he spoke to the City Club of Cleveland.
My question is that author and former Nixon administration official Kevin Phillips, in his latest book, American Theocracy, discusses what has been called radical Christianity and its growing involvement into government and politics. He makes the point that members of your administration have reached out to prophetic Christians who see the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism as signs of the apocalypse. Do you believe this, that the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism are signs of the apocalypse? And if not, why not?
The answer is, I haven't really thought of it that way. Here's how I think of it. First, I've heard of that, by the way. I guess I'm more of a practical fella.
As you heard in that question, Kevin Phillips' new book, American Theocracy, elaborates on his concerns about radical religion and politics. He fears that the Republican Party has been transformed into the first religious party in the U.S. But it's not just religion he writes about in American Theocracy. He warns about the dangers of our growing debt and dependence on oil. His previous book, American Dynasty, was about the Bush family's impact on American politics and policy. Phillips is very critical of the Republican Party, but he started his career helping to get Richard Nixon elected in 1968 and serving in his administration. Phillips' first book, The Emerging Republican Majority, which was published in 1969, was described in Newsweek as the political Bible of the Nixon era. I spoke to Phillips yesterday before the president addressed the City Club of Cleveland. Kevin Phillips, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book is subtitled The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Do you see radical religion, oil, and borrowed money as being interconnected in any way?
Very much, and much more after I finished the book than when I began it. To begin with the question of radical religion and oil, what you found in the whole lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, for example, is that George W. Bush, with his constituency of true believers, was responding in part to their whole sense of an end times and Armageddon context in the Middle East. And as a result, they interpreted what was going on there through a biblical lens, as opposed to an oil sensitivity lens that might have been the case, say, in the upper echelons of Exxon in Houston. And the upshot was that you couldn't talk about oil as a reason for invading Iraq because so much of the constituency had a religious reason for watching all of this, but yet the two are very much connected. If you think in terms of the questions of debt and oil, for example, again, very, very much connected because the more that we go into hock to foreigners in order to pay for the imported oil, which is a very major portion of what we import, the worse the whole crisis gets, because the bigger the debt, the greater the strain on the dollar. And if the dollar starts to fade again, that just raises the price of oil. So all of these things come together, and it is the triangle that Washington does not want to discuss.
Why do you think Washington doesn't want to discuss it?
Too many bedrock issues and concerns and things for which there is no obvious solution. To admit that debt has many, many consequences in terms of what we have to do to get oil, where we may have to invade, to admit that in Iraq we're not there for democracy, we're not there for all the pretense. There may be trumpets of democracy, but it's drums of gasoline. All of this just raises too many issues about the fundamental mess the United States has gotten itself in, really for 15 or 20 years, with the collaboration of presidents of both parties. George W. Bush wasn't the only one talking about weapons of mass destruction.
But you do say that the Bush family has helped tie together finance, national security, oil, and the religious right. Would you talk a little bit about the role you think the Bush family has played in connecting those things?
part of the reason why the Bush family is such a problem for us at this point and for the Republican Party is that with the exception of the election of 1996, there has been a Bush on the Republican ticket running for president or vice president in every election since 1980. They have really put a firm fingerprint on the Republican Party. And the three things that they've been involved in doing that are so important to what's happened. The first is that because of George H.W. Bush's difficulties with a religious right, he developed the art of pandering to these people to a pretty elevated degree. His son got into politics in the national vein in 1987, 1988, being his father's liaison to the religious right. So these two men together have really pushed the Republican Party in that direction. The second thing that they've done is that four generations of Bushes have come out of the financial sector. They've been brokers, they've been investment managers, they've been bankers. They have this attunement to the financial sector. And the financial sector has become relentlessly more important in this country in the last two decades. And the Bushes have helped this find fruition. And then lastly, with oil, you have George H.W. Bush, who was the first oil man to be president. By the time we got to the 2000 election with George W. Bush, he was not only himself an oilman, although a very unsuccessful one, but he had a vice presidential running mate who was also out of the oil business, Dick Cheney. So the extent to which the Bush family and the 25 years in which they've had a major imprint on the Republican Party has emphasized pandering to the radical right, the religious right, the role and importance of oil and connections to finance help explain a lot of what has happened. And the fact that these are central crises for the United States at this point is not unrelated to the prominence of the Bushes.
You write about what you describe as the oil national security complex when you're writing about the role that you think oil has played in foreign policy. How influential was oil when you worked for the Nixon administration in the late 60s?
Well, it was enormously important in the 1960s, partly because you could see some clouds on the horizon, but even more because within the Republican Party, the great goal of realigning politics in the Republicans' favor rested in no small part on Texas. Texas was a very important state, and it was the great oil state. And Richard Nixon really wanted to take Texas, and that was one of the reasons why he was very interested in promoting the career of George Bush Sr., who was the first major Republican from Texas, and that was part of a long-term Nixon strategy to sort of Texify the Republican Party a bit.
And you're right that the new battle regarding oil was defined in 1973 when Secretary of State Kissinger and others in the cabinet promoted, just short of openly, a plan for using U.S. airborne forces to seize oil fields of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Abu Dhabi. What was the plan?
Well, the plan that was discussed pretty covertly with the British was basically to take over those oil fields, just use American power bluntly and openly. You can say in retrospect that maybe it would have worked, but we went instead under Carter towards a politics of trying to conserve energy and reduce oil dependence, and that also worked. I think it was a better option. But there is a larger context which is important to mention, and that's that really for 100 years now, the military focus on the Middle East has been oil-related. The emerging oil fields of Saudi Arabia, of Iraq, of Iran have been targets. They were targets in World War I. They were targets in World War II. They've been targets ever since. The notion that a war is fought in that part of the world and it is not related to oil is a joke.
So if you think that oil is really the motivating force behind the war in Iraq, what about the neoconservatives who made the argument that the war in Iraq would democratize Iraq and a democracy in Iraq would inspire other countries to become democratic and it would change the whole face of that region? Oil was not their argument. Democracy was their argument. And so how do you think that compares in the Bush administration's motivation for war with the oil argument.
Well, back when George W.'s father invaded the Persian Gulf to expel the Iraqis from Kuwait, he and James Baker, then the Secretary of State, were up front. They said it was about energy, and you couldn't have Saddam Hussein controlling all the oil resources of the Gulf. Now, nobody was saying we have to bring democracy to Baghdad. But because of the sort of odd quirks of the second Bush administration, first, the extent to which they had all the biblical interpretation people in the Republican coalition, and then secondly, the neoconservatives, who at least pretended to be more concerned about democracy, but frankly, I don't think that was what they were concerned about. I think they were concerned about the geopolitics of the Middle East, and democracy was just icing on a geopolitical cake.
You write that the last two presidential elections mark the transformation of the GOP into the first religious party in U.S. history. Now, I mean, no one would argue that the Republican Party has strong support from the religious right, but in what way do you see the Republican Party as a religious party?
Well, let me start with a little bit further back chronology. Back after the 1988 elections, a political scientist in Ohio by the name of John Green, who's subsequently become quite well known for putting together religion and politics, suggested that because of the role of religion in 1988 with Pat Robertson running for president and bringing more of the Pentecostals and Southern fundamentalists into the Republican Party, that you were really beginning to centralize religious people of all persuasions in the United States in the Republican Party. By the time we got to 2000 and 2004, this was much more clear than it had been back then, partly because Bill Clinton, although a Southern Baptist, became anathema to the church-going Baptist and many others in the South. And then in 2001, the whole role of religion came to the fore after 9/11 because George Bush was structuring a fight between good and evil. So the upshot was that by 2000 and 2004, you were looking at a very, very strong correlation between religiosity of people, more than church attendance, but that was a fair part of it, or religious services attendance. And you wound up for the first time ever, I can't think of any precedent in American history, where the religious Protestants, the religious Catholics, and the Orthodox Jews were all on the same side and strongly conservative and strongly Republican. The only exception is that among religious blacks, they weren't Republican, but they were more Republican than the other blacks and were motivated very much by some of the church-related issues, including gay marriage.
Your book is called American Theocracy, which will imply that you see our government now as being a religious government where religion, the rules of religion apply to the country. I mean, why use such a strong word?
Well, I use a strong word because I think in a country like this, as big as this and as diverse as the United States, we've got about as much right now as you can have in the direction of theocracy. And it's a major problem. But let me give you a quick summary of why I think there really is a major theocratic element here. First off, we have this high correlation now between church attendance and voting Republican. We have the Republicans in several cases openly caught trying to organize the churches and get lists of congregational members and communicants and what have you. We have a Republican rank and file. I have two pages of charts in the book that shows the theocratic inclinations of the Republican electorate. For example, should religious leaders try to influence politicians' positions on the issues? The country as a whole says no by 2-1, but white conservative evangelicals say yes by 62-37%. Another yardstick, which is very significant, is you've got a president who in the course of years since 1999 and 2000 has often been quoted by people as saying he thinks God chose him to lead the country. Now, you can say he believes this, but he's even said, been quoted in Middle East papers, although the White House denies it, that God told him to invade Afghanistan and told him to invade Iraq. You have a Republican rank and file approximately 50 to 55% of whom believe in Armageddon. And the Antichrist is alive now. You have Republican state conventions, one recently, the Texas State Convention in 2004, that passed one of these platforms calling the United States a Christian nation and getting into all the things about how religion and government have to become closer and the sort of government agencies that they would abandon. You've just got all these different yardsticks. This is a major transformation of an American political party.
My guest is Kevin Phillips. His new book is called American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. Let's talk about the third leg of your argument here, which is borrowed money. Now, in your book, when talking about debt, you describe the credit card, mortgage, auto loan, corporate debt, federal borrowing, industrial complex, which you describe in short as a reckless credit-feeding financial complex. Now, there's been a lot of focus lately on the national debt, but you're talking here in part about personal debt. So how does personal debt figure into the larger picture that you're writing about, you know, in terms of America's predicament?
Let me take this question of debt and a debt-related industry and the growth of that industry and put it in a quick context. In the 1960s and 70s, by far and away the largest portion of the American economy, single portion, was manufacturing. Its share of GDP was, in the mid-20s, and finance was pretty small. But as debt grew, both public and private, in the United States in the 70s and 80s and 90s, slowly but surely, the industry of handling debt and managing money has raised its share of the gross domestic product, so it is now far ahead of manufacturing. Now, manufacturing gave a lot of lower, middle, and blue-collar people in the United States middle-class status. They got to have fishing cabins in northern Michigan. They got to have good jobs. Well, that's all moving offshore as we do the money thing now. But the money thing is inherently so favorable to the upper brackets, to the people who have capital and who basically just move money around and have it aggrandized, that it erodes the work ethic of the country, and you get the money ethic rises to the fore. And we have so much debt now, and we're so willing to borrow money overseas, that at some point, the people from whom we borrowed, be they Asian central banks or people in the Middle East with oil money, they're going to call it. And at that point, the dollar weakens enormously. And for a lot of Americans, that just means, instead of marginal middle class status that's no longer marginal middle class, it's out of the middle class.
In your book, you warn that U.S. global supremacy could drain away more in 5 to 20 years than most Americans would have thought possible. Exactly what are you warning about?
That's a triple warning. I'll try to give a very, very short version of the triple play. Essentially, the United States, by trying to reach too far as part of a global hubris and a sense of destiny and democracy and everything like that, is at great risk of what historians call overstretch, of trying to bite off more than it can finance and more than it can afford, and without an intelligent blueprint for doing so. And lack of an intelligent blueprint is a wonderful one-sentence description of Bush policy in the Middle East. Nothing they blueprinted has worked out. Debt is mounting. As debt mounts, the dollar tends to weaken. As the dollar weakens, the cost of oil goes up. As we are preoccupied with finance and debt, we make less and less. So we have to buy more of the things that machinery and consumer goods overseas. And then that just puts us further in debt. This is an enormous mess. The extent to which we have a government that has no sense of proportion or history is a huge problem. But I would underscore again that while the principal burden is on the Republicans, the Democrats are so inept in understanding these same things that they don't know what to criticize. Either that or they're basically funded by a lot of the same industries anyway.
As we've mentioned, you started your career as a Republican strategist with the Nixon administration. How do you define yourself politically now? Republican, Democrat, none of the above?
Well, I'm an independent, and I really do like the idea of none of the above. I think if we could ever have none of the above on the ballot, it'd elect two-thirds of Congress. But some of my politics is still somewhat conservative. I don't relate to the across-the-board liberalism. And I don't think of myself as being liberal when I critique the Republican Party. I would say you've got a mix of radical religion. You've got radical oil dependence, which isn't sufficiently acknowledged or recognized. And you've got a radical extension of debt. So maybe I'm the conservative and maybe they're the wild-eyed people and they're conspiring to keep their incompetence from being noticed. But, you know, it is being noticed.
Kevin Phillips, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Kevin Phillips is the author of the new book, American Theocracy. You can find an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Next week, I'll speak with Fred Barnes, whose new book, Rebel in Chief, praises President Bush.